Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Of all of the many different times and places we've covered on this season of Tides, the Indus Valley Civilization stands out to me the most. A huge, long-lived, sophisticated urban society ensconced along the riverbanks of South Asia, but one that left us no legible written materials that might give us an inside view into its workings. In this sense, the Indus Valley Civilization is something of a black box. We see incredible archaeological remains, whole cities, built-up rural landscapes, but what it all means is a bit harder to figure out. That's why I'm so stoked to talk to our guest today. He's a specialist on the Indus Valley Civilization, and he has some fascinating insights about everything from its relationship to a changing climate to its internal social structure. Dr. Adam Green is an anthropological archaeologist who works as an affiliated lecturer in the Department of Archaeology at Cambridge. He's published numerous pieces about various aspects of the Indus Valley Civilization and more broadly works on the comparative study of ancient human economies, landscapes, and urban societies. Dr. Green, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the basics here. How do we define the Indus Valley Civilization in time and space?
Yeah, so the Indus Civilization is broadly referring to the pristine urban society that emerged in South Asia in the 3rd millennium BC, around 2600 BC. And it was incredibly extensive, covering an area extending from the Himalaya Mountains to the Arabian Sea. And there's a huge amount of environmental diversity in this region. So that it's not quite the same as some of the other early complex societies, early urban societies you see in other parts of the world, in that it's actually covering various different kinds of coastal arid zones, riverine zones, areas with really, really complicated hydrology. And they're all a little bit different. And yet there's this civilization that appears throughout these different zones and encompassing really thousands of small settlements and a handful of really big ones, and those are the ones that are traditionally identified as cities. There's five major ones that are commonly discussed in the context of early urbanism. So everybody talks about Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, but there's also Dholavira and Rakhigari in northwest India. And then you would also, many scholars would also include Ganwariwala, which is an unexcavated site in the arid region of Cholistan, which is kind of right in the middle of all of these areas. And Indus settlements are very interesting because anywhere you go, you would encounter kind of a bustling settlement full of carts, lots of different Bronze Age goods, a surprising variety of different foods, different kinds of craft objects, and people sort of wearing different kinds of textiles and all kinds of complex ornaments. You'd often find massive brick structures as well as sort of small brick structures that were incredibly well designed, sophisticated masonry techniques. You'll find private houses with a range of amenities known only to the kings and pharaohs of other Bronze Age societies, things like bathing platforms, drainage, these kinds of things. And you see a great variety of different kinds of buildings using sort of a header stretcher masonry, a kind of technology that doesn't appear in other urban societies until almost 1,000 years later. And so, yeah, that's kind of the thing. I guess one of the big things you would see throughout the Indus, throughout sort of the thousands of small-scale settlements that are often associated with the sites and with a lot of the big cities, are, generally speaking, public goods. Big things that sometimes require lots of labor, things like street plans, city walls, gates, things that require a lot of people to invest their labor in them. But in the Indus, they're very distinctive in that they seem to be available to a large amount or most of the people, or if not all of the people, to enjoy. So a lot of the public labor is going into things that a lot of people are able to use and take advantage of, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. It's really fascinating because it strikes me that as we're comparing the Indus to other early civilizations, that what we define as quote unquote civilization seems to be available to a much broader swath of the populace in the Indus than it does in Egypt or in Mesopotamia or in Shang China, for example, where it's like, even if you have these incredible buildings, even if you have like sophisticated hydraulic systems and gardens and things like that, they're for a very, very limited slice of the populace.
Yeah. And I mean, the Indus, there were also these sort of like large non-residential structures that were built and took just lots and lots of people to construct, but they're not meaningfully closed off, and they don't look like Mediterranean palaces. They don't look like they're combining the residence of a small group of people with the sort of administrative apparatus of a polity. Instead, they look like they're providing some form of service that's accessible to lots and lots of different people. Things like the Great Bath and Mohenjo-Daro, though they're off sort of on another mound, they're generally, you know, well connected to a very wide street and accessible across the settlement. So, yeah, it's very striking, the openness of a lot of the big public things that tend to be closed off when you see sort of analogous structures built in other early urban contexts.
So that must create a really interesting analytical problem if you're trying to understand the Indus Valley civilization. If we don't have written texts, but we have these urban plans that differ so markedly from what we see elsewhere, that creates kind of a problem of understanding parallels, right? Coming up with mental frameworks for how to understand this archaeological material.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say archaeologists and social theorists and political scientists, basically across disciplines, really actually struggle when you can't individualize the sort of social decision-making process that's being materialized by an ancient society, or it's being materialized on a very wide scale. We have, especially in contemporary thinking, a desire to look for the manager or to look for the leader or to try to find the person in charge. But oftentimes, the person in charge might not be a fixed point, might not be where we want to sort of place our theory. And that does create a lot of challenges in interpreting the archaeology of sort of big collective things. Because basically in the Indus, you get a lot of evidence of big collective things, big things happening on a social scale, on sort of a social scale that's encompassing many different households, many different everyday communities, but aren't necessarily being sort of dominated or controlled by a stratified elite that's totally sort of off from the rest of the populace.
I mean, that was something that was really striking to me. You wrote this fantastic recent article called Killing the Priest King on exactly this issue of stratification and the elite. And one of the things that you point out that I thought was just, that I thought was so fascinating, was that scholars have looked and looked and looked for some sort of ruling class or a king, like the priest king that you mentioned in the title of that piece, but the evidence doesn't present one. It's just not there. So why have they looked so hard for an elite for this sophisticated urban society? Why have they assumed that it had to have one?
Well, I mean, in a lot of comparative archaeology and in a lot of studies of long-term social change, studies of social theory, it's often assumed that to get the good things that come along with civilization, things like technological invention, art, economic growth, economic prosperity, you have to put up with a certain degree of the sort of bad things, things like inequality, things like warfare. And this is a pretty fundamental assumption built into theories of social change, particularly what archaeologists would call a neo-evolutionary theory, which assembles sort of packets of different traits into stages and then tries to look at how those stages proceed through a sequence. So you can't have cities until you have stratification, and then you need the stratification to give you rulers who then sort of provision specialists to give you all the other different things. So the earliest sort of the many archaeological theories of complex societies were thus about looking at how societies balance out the good and the bad. But in the Indus, it's clear kind of right from the outset that the evidence doesn't play along with the rules of traditional archaeological theory. It's famous. So when you read the reports, they're famous for lots and lots of evidence of the good things, the big buildings, the sophisticated technologies, the high economic growth, without the sort of really clear indications of the bad things, the exclusionary things, the classically palaces, exclusionary temples, and, you know, mortuary contexts, tombs that involve huge amounts of labor, but are closed off or dedicated to just a really tiny group of people. I mean, in brief, that would be why there was a tendency in Indus archaeology to reconcile the evidence from the Indus with those neo-evolutionary theorists. On the one hand, were especially from the 90s and early 2000s, on the one hand, were archaeologists who said, oh, the Indus civilization simply doesn't tick off the boxes to be a quote-unquote state-level society. And so there was an argument, most famously by Greg Pissell in 1998, that the Indus was not a state-level society. It was complexity without the state, it was with the case made. And then kind of almost a reaction against that perspective, that, you know, of scholars who simply saw too much amazing technology, too much amazing economic change in the Indus to argue that it wasn't a state-level society, so or that argue that it wasn't a state. So that would be in the article, I call them the state-level paradigm. There was this argument that the Indus, there was kind of an assumption right at the start that the Indus was a state-level society. So if you make that assumption right at the start, you assume that you're going to find all the other bits and pieces that new evolutionary theory assumes should be in a state-level society. And so all these arguments, almost all these sort of special pleading arguments about how, if you have the products of craft specialists, there must be elites organizing the craft specialists. So if you have really, really fancy things, there must be someone aggregating the resources for people to make those fancy things in the background. And they just hadn't been seen properly. So that's kind of where the article was coming from. And I suppose I wrote the article because I had basically, by the time I got to writing it, I guess I had spent about a decade working on the Indus. Initially, I worked on the organization of the production of stamp seals. So really, probably one of the most sophisticated artifacts produced in the Indus civilization. We can talk more about the technologies as you want, but really, like, these stones were heated over 1,200 degrees Celsius. They have the, you know, you spoke that we can't read the script, but they're the largest source of information on the script. They're inscribed with these complex inscriptions. They have these really, really intricate carvings of animals. And they're used to make ceilings. So they're used to press, they're pressed into clay to make ceilings on doors and containers and basically track information about interactions between people. So my thinking from the outset was that if you're going to see any kinds of concentrations of power or disparities in power, they should be manifesting in the production and use of the Indus seals. So I studied the seals, found they were being made by lots of different groups, a finding that's been echoed by a lot of different studies and a lot of different technologies in the Indus. And it kind of got me to reflect on what attracted me to the Indus in the very beginning, which was this economic complexity. And I decided that I wasn't convinced by a lot of the arguments that technological complexity was on its own evidence for a separate ruling class, evidence for a ruling class that should be sort of organizing all that complexity. There seemed to be lots of ways to me for that complexity to be organized without it. So that's kind of why I went into the article. Why was there such a drive to force evidence from the end of civilization, which is telling such an interesting story about economic growth and urbanism and public goods, into this box about exclusionary political hierarchy, especially when, you know, neo-evolutionary archaeology in itself was sort of being left behind by the discipline. It faced massive critiques in the early 2000s and the 2010s. And so it's just like a lot of evidence, even in sort of classic contexts like Mesopotamia, there was mounting evidence that the story was being mistold. So I thought it was time to go back to the Indus and really start listening, really start looking at what the evidence was telling us about how early cities could be organized.
It's a really fascinating example of finding what you expect to see and seeing what you expect to find. That was just so striking because, like, when you look at early Egypt or early Mesopotamia, like you point out, there's lots of bad stuff. Like, there's human sacrifice in early dynastic tombs in Egypt. Copious evidence for massive scale slavery and warfare in early Mesopotamia. One of the most common of the early legible words in the cuneiform corpus is like the female slave of foreign origin, right? Like, this is the bad stuff. And so it's really striking that when that's the model that you have in mind, you're going to project that onto something, even when the actual explicit evidence isn't there for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. We have to move closer to the archaeological evidence and start searching for ways to really explain these phenomena, the phenomena that I think we're actually interested in, which are things like technological innovation, public goods, the thriving, how does a city thrive for 700 years? How does a city thrive for the greater part of a millennium? These are things that we want to know. These are things that are very interesting to us. But there's kind of a commitment, especially in a lot of Western narratives of political philosophy, those kinds of things that they're necessarily sort of passed on and given to us by a ruling class, by a specific handful of people who pick good strategies or pick bad strategies, and we all have to follow them.
Well, it strikes me that one of the downsides of that particular perspective is even if what you're trying to understand is an elite group, that's a limiting way of looking at an elite. And understanding how an elite can influence decision-making in a society, what kinds of resources a society values, how it can direct them. Even if that's what you're interested in studying, that approach can lead you astray.
Yeah, yeah. You get to the point where you're kind of imposing that on the evidence, irregardless of what you're seeing. So oftentimes I've seen sort of in a neighboring context, so like in Mesopotamia in particular, and in later contexts, I think some of the ones that you might be interested in or that you've written about a bit in terms of like the classical world, where you start seeing like entire settlements being identified as like an elite Roman settlement or an elite Iron Age settlement, because they're all looking relatively materially egalitarian, so that the households are looking very similar to one another at the site level. But there's an assumption that because it's an elite settlement or because buildings themselves are an elite settlement, that what you're doing is you're seeing sort of a snapshot of a particularly elite context, of a particularly elite lifestyle. So the problem of elite agency really sort of pervades lots of different contexts for archaeological interpretation.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like, every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
So if we're trying to understand the Indus Valley civilization, we can't just turn to an all-powerful elite as our means of understanding decision-making and the distribution of resources. How should we understand it? What are some of the concepts that we should be using to try to understand how things happen in the Indus Valley?
Yeah. So I've already spoken a little bit about things like economic growth, technological change. These are processes that I think can be very artisan driven. We can use concepts like agricultural sustainability and human environment interactions to understand the way people pursuing different food production strategies in different environments have to interact with one another in order to sort of share the gains of one particular strategy with another. These are kind of some topics that have been sort of near and dear to the heart of our research group here in Cambridge that we've been working on. But then I think there's another element, and you know, everyone wants to know sort of how an egalitarian city is organized, or how a complex society would be organized, how it might be functioning. And so this is a topic that I've worked on very recently as part of a group that's putting together a series of archaeology papers for a political science journal. There's a special issue on the origins of basically democratic governance in the journal Frontiers of Political Science that's basically arguing that a lot of the traditional political theories of governance are based on a lot of sort of bad assumptions about the past, and that archaeological evidence does a lot to sort of contradict or problematize very, very simplistic narratives of the Western democracy story. That, in fact, there's all these forms of democratic governance that appear in the archaeological record all over the world. So it's a whole series of papers that I encourage you to check out. They're coming out. And I just wrote the one on the Indus civilization. So I've argued that we shouldn't use elite agency to explain urban development and technological change in the Indus. But that kind of leads to the next question. Okay, so if elite agency isn't what's explaining these things, what is? Because at the end of the day, you're still seeing very large-scale forms of social organization. You're still seeing huge numbers of people invest their labor into particular things, practices that just have to be organized. And you're seeing huge amounts of coordination between social groups that can't be very closely related. Things like the production of a standardized weight system that's stretching all the way from, you know, coastal Gujarat to the foothills of the Himalaya. So these are things that are absolutely being coordinated in some way and in some level. And I've argued that the Indus civilization was basically an egalitarian urban society. So what this means is that in the Indus, you have egalitarian governance. And so the next question is, well, how do you get egalitarian governance? What is egalitarian governance? And this question always surprises me, given that many major countries in the world today officially self-identify as democratic, egalitarian, like that self-identify as countries that are pursuing this equality ideal. And we have in our own political discourse all kinds of means and mechanisms of smoothing out political power, smoothing out economic resources that are kind of everyday parts of political economic discourse in our day-to-day. I mean, you know, elections are the most obvious example, but there's all kinds of other things. Term limits, task rotations, collecting revenue for very sort of specific jobs. These are all kinds of things that are kind of hallmarks of a lot of egalitarian societies today. So there's lots of things, I guess. Blanton and his colleagues talk about good governance as a way of incorporating the voice of everyday communities into political decision-making. And we already have all kinds of ideas about what incorporating democratic voice into political decision-making looks like. Why is it so sort of strange to imagine a Bronze Age urban context of people sort of doing things like inclusive deliberation, coming together to discuss potential sort of collective investments, things like establishing term limits, sharing information with one another. So in another range of arguments, I've written a lot about the importance of democratized information or the distribution of the means of specification. All societies have ways to materialize information, and we can actually look at how that material is moving through a lot of early societies, and things like vetoes and all manner of others. So in the Indus, I think there's pretty good evidence both of governance that's happening from the bottom up, between everyday communities that are coming together to agree on things like standards for brick production or standards for weight production. Because in the craft production literature, there's evidence of what Paul Rissman and Rita Wright called guild-like organizations. There seems to be some pretty good evidence that there were specialized corporate groups able to exert some control on how over how crafts were produced, or some agreement on how crafts were produced and how they were distributed. So that's sort of a bottom-up process that could be happening. But then there's also sort of little glimpses. There must also be evidence of sort of top-down and middle-out sort of decision-making going on at the same time. So there's plenty of sort of candidates for deliberative spaces in Indus cities. At Mohenjo-Daro, there's a pillared hall that was constructed sort of south of the Great Bath. It's just a very big room with benches that are sort of snaking back and forth between these different pillars. It's a place where a lot of people could have met up. A lot of people could have chatted. They could have done deliberation just in the absolute most general terms, coming together, sharing a meal, having a chat, deciding on what the everyday households of the city were going to invest their labor in. We have sort of evidence of those spaces. And then we also have evidence of institutional spaces, or sort of specialized spaces for actually sort of organizing and implementing political decisions. So I've written about small public buildings at Mohenjo-Daro. There are speckled throughout the city small public structures. So they're structures that are accessible from lots of different communities that aren't households, and they aren't associated with the neighborhoods, which appear to sort of actually manage a lot of their construction internally. And so these would have provided really an ideal space to do things like plan out the construction of a wall, or plan out the next crop cycle outside the city, or ensure that all the different neighborhoods are conforming to the street plans. So, I mean, there's evidence of both of these kinds of structures. They're not that different from evidence of governance in other societies. But there's no reason to think that those sort of mechanisms of governance were necessarily sort of under the fixed control of some really exclusionary tiny group of people. The other point I would make about Indus governance, about egalitarian governance in the Indus, it's that the sort of wide distribution of information seems to have also played a major role. So in addition to things like deliberative spaces and institutional spaces, offices for sort of managing city projects or whatever, you also have the Indus Seals, where I actually started working on the Indus civilization. And the Indus Seals, which sort of exemplify Indus technological knowledge, the Indus economic prosperity, these seals, they're not restricted to a tiny group of users in the Indus cities. As a matter of fact, they're actually found more often outside of the large non-residential building districts than they are within them. They're found in the everyday houses. So houses are full of Indus seals. So the most common tool for recording information, and I realize this all may seem very strange because we don't use seals in our day-to-day life, so it's kind of hard to imagine. But imagine the tool for signing things, the tool for recording things. This is something that was available to all of the houses, at least at the big major excavated sites like Mohenjo-Daro, but even at a lot of the small-scale sites too. The seals are found in the everyday households. So the tools for recording, for specifying in particular what you owe to another household or what you might be paying in, these tools were widely distributed. Broadly speaking, you could say that Indus communities were collectively aware of what kinds of resources there were out there for them to manage. even if no single group was managing those resources or extracting those resources from other groups. So hopefully that makes some sense.
Yeah. No, it makes a ton of sense, because there's this striking tendency kind of over all of history to give elites too much credit and everybody else not enough credit, where, like, even in seemingly the most elite dominated context you can find, say the medieval countryside, right? It's not like lords of the manor are dictating what their peasants do on a daily basis for the most part. Like, sure, they may be setting kind of overarching guidelines, but for the most part, peasants are governing themselves in their own little communities. And, like, maybe they see a bailiff once in every once in a while. Maybe they see a tax collector every once in a while. But for the most part, they're living according to their own rules and they're managing themselves. And there's this strong tendency to see the hierarchy everywhere and not the spaces in between the hierarchy, or to understand hierarchy as all pervasive instead of being a conditional or contextual thing. Where sometimes the hierarchy is absolutely operational, right? Like, if the bailiff comes and he's got a half dozen soldiers, like, yeah, you're in the hierarchy then. But if you're just having a little dispute with your neighbor over a boundary, like, that's something you can handle yourselves. You doesn't have to have recourse to some broader structure of authority or power.
Yeah, I think we'd have a tendency to maybe sell short how widespread those kinds of, I don't know what the right word would be, but those kinds of middle out forms of governance could be, because I think there's good evidence that in the Indus, that's precisely so. Interactions, probably non-hierarchical interactions between communities of specialists, guild-like organizations has been the word that has been used. And I think it's probably as close as we're going to get in this instance. But there might not have been sort of one of these artisan groups in charge of making sure that all the seals were about 2.5 centimeters by 2.5 centimeters, or all the weights weighed properly. But probably there was some form of agreement between them on how much a weight should weigh, just so that the system would work across such a huge area. And so I think it's really striking that things like weights and measures, seals and ceilings, they were standardized across this whole area. And there doesn't seem to be sort of a fixed top-down entity exerting that standardization across such an area. Or at least we don't have the standardization alone shouldn't be taken as evidence. It seems like this is something that's happening almost as a horizontal interaction between different communities.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I want to follow up on that real quick, because there's a tendency with the Indus Valley, again, to focus on these large urban sites, but the vast majority of people living in the Indus Valley are not living in the massive cities. They're living in smaller, you might call them towns, villages, hamlets out in the countryside. And yet there's a remarkable level of integration between the countryside and these cities. And again, to your point, like, traditionally, that's been seen as a sign of top-down domination, forcing the integration between large urban sites and the countryside. But here, where if we accept that that's not the case, we've got to find other mechanisms for explaining the homogeneity of construction methods, of seals, and also incentives for people to interact with one another, which is, I mean, it's a huge task to try to explain that in the absence of a model where you can just say that that somebody at the top is making everybody do it.
Yeah, no, and you've just honed in on probably what will be one of the most dynamic and growing topics in Indus studies, probably for the next 10 years. And that is clarifying the sort of urban-rural dynamics that were at play in the Indus, because most Indus settlements aren't these massive cities. There's only four of the cities that have been excavated. They're incredibly far away from each other. hundreds of kilometers. And between them are just, depending on which data set you look at, you know, between hundreds and thousands of these much smaller settlements. And our excavation data from these smaller settlements is not as abundant as what was produced by the sort of early excavations at big sites like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. So this is a really active area of research. There's basically been two big papers that have looked at it. One was by Parikh and Petrie, which looks at rural complexity in the Indus, and they argue that there's basically, you're seeing lots of very similar kinds of complexity in a lot of these smaller settlements as you see in some of the large urban settlements. And then you also have, there's a range of papers that came out as part of the Baez project by Wright and some of the Harappa team members that were basically trying to establish the distribution of settlements around Harappa. And Wright calls these satellite settlements because they did intensive surveys of a handful of these settlements, and they find a lot of the same material culture that's in the cities. Things like platforms, big heavy brick platforms, pointed base goblets with impressions in them, all kinds of different craft goods. And so she doesn't see a huge difference between what's going on in the rural settlements and in the satellite settlements and what's going on in the city. At the end of the day, some of these settlements need to be investigated more systematically. We need excavation data from a lot of these settlements to really characterize what is going on. I suspect, based on what's out there already, but what's come from sites like Banawali, excavated by Bisht, Kalibangan, excavated by Atarpar and team, that you're not seeing quite as much differentiation between some of these small-scale sites and some of the cities as you might expect to. And while I would say that's a pattern that's particularly interesting in the Indus, I also suspect that sometimes rural-urban distinctions are overemphasized in other early urban contexts as well, and that we just kind of need a more expansive way of thinking about what these links are.
I think one of the reasons it's so hard to study mobility in those contexts, to say personal mobility, and if you were actually able to reconstruct kind of the mobility patterns of your average rural person in an Indus Valley settlement, you might find that they make regular trips to a big city, that, you know, they either they're taking goods there, or they're traveling for some sort of festival, or they're traveling because they have family there as part of some kind of cross-cutting craft organization that you may call a guild. They're to get training or to take a child to go learn a craft in a major urban center. That, like, there's lots of reasons for people to move. And we have such a strong tendency to see mobility as a point A to point B journey, as opposed to regular cycles of movement through a given space, that's going to the inability to see that in an archaeological context makes it tough sometimes. And it strikes me as we look at the Indus, like, that has all the hallmarks of like a hyper connected society where people are doing that kind of short range regular movement all the time, that it strikes me that that's kind of the best way to explain how you can have a kind of collective decision-making processes or middle-out governance, is if people are talking to one another all the time, lots of different people are talking to lots of different people, and you've got roads, canals, rivers, the means of transportation. So you've got a kind of an environment that lends itself to connectivity and social practices that reinforce like strong patterns of mobility.
Yeah. There's definitely going to be flows between a lot of these different settlements and on all kinds of different scales. So, I mean, it's undeniable that one of the major features of the urban settlements in particular is the ability to draw in resources from extraordinarily long distances. So, like, the work from Randall Law in particular has highlighted the fact that a lot of the stone resources are coming from highland sources that are really hundreds of kilometers away from the places where the stone is ultimately being turned into all these different craft objects that are then circulating through the settlements. And that's something that appears to be extremely urban, even though you do see raw materials cropping up in a lot of the small-scale settlements as well. So it's one of those things that's probably going to vary by material, and it's going to vary according to these different interregional networks as they're reconstructed. But, Yeah, your comments on mobility are important. And I should note there's going to be a series of landscape studies coming out from the research group here that are focusing on things like how different isotope patterns are revealing animal movement across different parts of Northwest India in particular. You can sort of factor in assumptions based on the fact that like bullock carts are a very common feature of Indus assemblages. But, you know, a bullock cart only has an effective range of about 25 kilometers. That's about a daily route for bullock cart. And even that would be, you know, that would be kind of at the extreme end of how much you would want to move that animal around from a small-scale settlement. But again, you have dozens of little small-scale settlements easily within 25 kilometers of a big city like Rakhigarhi. So you might see things like bulk commodities moving between these small-scale settlements in the urban center. But then I think you've actually hit the nail on the head when you're talking about things like services, training, craft knowledge. These are things that we're probably pooling in the cities. These are probably outputs of interaction between lots and lots and lots of people. And the more people you have interacting, the more kinds of reservoirs of knowledge develop. And those are probably what is distinctive in an urban context. And so, yeah, no, I think that you're seeing sort of the signs of how the urban-rural picture of Indus political economy might change in the coming years as the rural data sets make their way into the discourse, even as the Indus civilization makes itself sort of takes its place in the broader comparative study of early societies and cultures. Because the Indus kind of, it was famously, so Bruce Trigger wrote an Understanding Early Civilizations Comparative Study in the early aughts. And he very famously wrote a line of, I'm going to exclude the Indus civilization from this book because we just don't know enough about it. And it was a little bit ironic because V. Gordon Childe's first book about urbanism and the development of urbanization is called The Most Ancient East. And it actually begins with the Indus civilization, which in the very first edition of his book, he thought the Indus civilization was kind of the font of urbanism. And he only revised it in new light on the most ancient East after more data from Mesopotamia had been published. So it's kind of, it's always struck me as one of those disciplinary ironies that the Indus civilization began as so important toward defining what we even think about as early urbanism. And then just slowly got pushed out of the conversation as sort of really problematic neo-evolutionary models took over archaeology. And I'm pretty happy that now I think we finally reached a point where we can start pushing that old thinking, that old elite-based thinking out and maybe start engaging with these topics a little bit more broadly.
Well, it seems, and not just in the Indus, though the Indus is a really striking example of it, that you know, kind of no matter where you look in prehistory, you're being forced to reckon with things that don't fit a neo-evolutionary package, like the Trypilia megasites in Ukraine, which are, you know, you could have 10, 15,000 people there, but there doesn't appear to be any obvious evidence of hierarchy. Those are fascinating sites, and they existed, and they existed for quite some time. And if you've got a theoretical explanation for how urbanism is supposed to work that does not include some of the earliest, longest lasting, and most extensive versions of that, then your theory is not very good.
You are not, I mean, and that's, you start to have to get, I mean, this is something that the series of Africanists who were working in the Sahel were sort of honing in on in the late 90s, early 2000s, when they're writing about like the ancient Middle Niger and some of these huge sites here, they're starting to sort of rightly point out that the number of exceptions to the rule are starting to really call into doubt our understanding of the rule. And so I think this is really striking, and it's something that we need to wrap our heads around and work on quite a bit more in the coming years. But I also think it's important to be wary of discarding pattern entirely and of just sort of saying things like, because one of the big problems with the neo-evolutionary narrative is that it ended on the city. It ended on the city and the state. So like when child service, when they reach the end of their progression of different stages and sequences, cities were the end of it. And that is where their narrative ended. And because we're now, you know, millennia into urbanism, the assumption is that basically what you get in Mohenjo-Daro is the same as what you have today. But I think it's very important not to disregard the fact that you then have thousands of years of political economy that happen after urbanism, and that you have all kinds of changes that go beyond and sort of start transforming a lot of these, what I believe is very egalitarian urban societies, into inegalitarian societies like we're more familiar with today, or that you start seeing these inequalities develop. So there's not a denial of inequalities in looking at things like Bronze Age urbanization and sort of the formation of egalitarian cities. It's just that maybe we need to sort of break apart that neo-evolutionary bundle and really start questioning what is giving you actual changes on the sort of inequality spectrum when you look through different points in time.
So as we kind of come to an end here, because I've taken up a great deal of your time, I wanted to end on climate. Climate's something that comes up a great deal with regard to the Indus Valley. It's a hot topic right now for a whole variety of reasons, some of which are connected to the present day. As we're trying to understand ancient civilizations, there's always the risk with climate, though, that it becomes kind of a blunt tool, that it becomes reductive as an explanation, that you just say, ah, well, there was a changing climate, and so this civilization fell or what have you. In the work that you've been doing recently, you've been doing some really fascinating stuff with climate that does not fall into the climate as a blunt tool category. You're working on rainfall patterns and the Indus Valley. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had the great opportunity to be part of the European Research Council funded Two Rains project, which was headed up by Cameron Petrie here at Cambridge. And it was entirely based on looking at the correlation between these big patterns in environmental change and their archaeological correlates. Because in the Indus, there is a climate change. So associated with the 4.2K event, there is a reduction in summer rainfall. There's a reduction in monsoon rainfall. It's hard to line up with the chronology of the Indus civilization. To put it briefly, it happens right in the middle of that urban period. And it's not like it happens and then Indus cities disappear. It's like you start to see these shifts in rainfall pattern, and then there are these sort of shifts in settlement that begin occurring. So one of the reasons I work in Northwest India is because it seems to be a pivot point that was involved in this sort of deurbanization process. In the legacy data sets, a lot of the published data sets from this region, there are many, 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 many more post-urban sites. So sites with indice material culture that post-date the cities, that post-date the sort of full deurbanization of the cities. And there's a lot more of them in Northwest India than there appear to be in other parts of the Indus civilization's extent. Now, it's tricky because what this area appears to have is better access to sort of monsoon rainfall than other regions. Yet that's precisely the weather phenomenon that changed with the 4.2K climate event. So that's exactly where, so it's very interesting that you see this pull toward this zone, even though the environmental data is saying that there would have actually been less water available from that source. And so these are all kind of interesting reasons to study this region, but there's also like hints of really interesting economic changes that happen as cities disappear. Because one of the things that's very interesting about the Indus is that when the cities disappear, those long-distance interaction networks seem to go with them. Those interaction networks that are pulling in stones from very, very far away, the script goes with them. But then you see an elaboration of a lot of local technologies in Northwest India. So one of the things that we've seen in survey data is that post-urban sites are still producing gobs and gobs and gobs of material culture. Lots and lots of ornaments, lots and lots of new fans becomes particularly big. So all there's still like this huge amount of craft knowledge that's being applied, but to new things or to elaborating forms that were common during sort of the height of Indus cities. Another thing that's interesting about these sort of long-term human-environment interactions, and this is something that's come out in particular in the work of Jennifer Bates, has been that the post-urban communities, the urban communities, and the pre-urban communities all seem to have an incredibly diversified pool of different summer and winter crops that they're working with. So there's kind of this rural flexibility that's there right from the beginning of sort of domesticated life in this region that goes all the way through this climate event and seems to be, it looks like one of sort of the pillars of sort of sustained human resilience in this region for a long period of time. And yet there's still that law there's still that loss of the urbanism. There's still there's a good perhaps around 1,000-year break between urbanization and then reurbanization in South Asia later, which has a very, very different look from what we know of the Indus civilization. And those links, Unfortunately, the post-urban period, we don't have really much excavation data to go on at all. So what we have in between the egalitarian cities of the Indus and the inegalitarian cities of the early historic is basically a big blank. So it's very difficult to tell the story of the origins of inequality in the Indus without that intervening data set.
Well, Dr. Green, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I thank you so much for your time, and I cannot wait to see the work that you're doing in the future.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.